Okay, a couple announcements. There won't be any lecture on Wednesday. I'm going to be tied up with a conference that we're hosting here. And no lecture Friday because of fall break. This will be the only lecture this week. Don't worry, as you've seen, probably looking at the lecture, you'll have plenty to do in power electronics. And that's related to this second bullet item. Looking ahead, I'll remind you of this next week. So we'll have lecture a week from today on Monday. And then Wednesday of next week, I'm also going to be out of town. We'll also have Wednesday off next week. So the design competition is posted. This is the UTK Tiny Box Challenge. I've already pointed out that you got my pun on the name. So what we're going to try to do, and these specifications are initial. These may change a little bit, but the general concept is going to stay the same throughout the semester. Is we're trying to design a 60-ish volt input to 12-ish volt output, 60-watt converter. Okay. The goal is to get it working in open loop, steady state operation. Okay. So there's no requirements for control, closed loop feedback, anything. You can, you know, if you want to test full power, you can set up the modulation signal, turn it on, bring it up to full power, take your operating point, then shut it off, redo everything programmatically. You can't change your hardware, bring it up to half load. You just need to test individual operating points, okay? And that's based on time and effort, right? There are requirements on input ripple current and output ripple voltage. They're related to full output power. Particularly with the output ripple voltage, this is, once you're operating, this is what is your kind of maximum amplitude of your ripple relative to the DC value. There's another spec here for your output voltage. It's 12 plus or minus 1. Does not mean that your ripple can be plus or minus 1 volt. It means I don't want you to have to spend a lot of time adjusting duty cycles to get exactly 12 volts. I'm saying get in the ballpark at 12 volts for your operating point, and then your ripple needs to be less than 2%. If you're 11.5, then it needs to be 2% of 11.5 if you're 12.5. Same. Okay. Efficiency, I'm going to look at on a weighted scale. This is something fabricated for this competition, but it's kind of similar to CEC efficiency, California Energy Commission. They do measurements like this where they're trying to get a net metric. I can call my converter 98% efficient if it's 98% efficient at half load, but it might be 80% efficient everywhere else. So this is trying to assess, is it highly efficient over the full range? I reduced it down somewhat because CEC efficiency has a couple more terms. I'm trying to reduce the number of points you actually have to test. No load power loss, less than 3 watts. Trying to get you to think about, for example, if you use the dual active bridge and it loses ZVS at light load, somehow you're going to have to think about, can I operate down there? Do I need to make modifications so that if my output power is very small, my converter does not enter a hard switching region and destroy itself? Volume, for purpose of the course, I'm saying should be less than 6 cubic inches. I think that's going to be fairly easy to meet with how we're what we're including in that. But subject to meeting these specifications, the winner of the competition is going to be the person who has the smallest volume. Just to motivate, is this kind of a real spec? Is this completely fabricated? To some extent, I've taken these numbers and manipulated them so that this is something that could be tractable within the remainder of the semester. But these specs will be very similar to some real applications. In electric vehicles, as I talked about in the very first lecture, there's a move towards a higher voltage bus. 42, 48, anything less than 60 they're considering here to allow more power to be delivered. A 12-volt bus currently has some 2-3 kilowatts of load on it from this lead-acid battery, requiring big, thick conductors and reaching the limit of what you can really do without increasing the weight of the vehicle significantly to get all that power through. So they're looking at bumping it up to 48. They would keep the 12-volt bus for all legacy systems, but you would need some kind of DC to DC going between 50-ish and 12. Okay, should be this one. Also in data centers, for similar reasons, data centers are looking at going to a 48-volt bus at the rack level. So power comes in, AC coming into the facility. At a rack of data center equipment, it gets converted over to 48 DC and then distributed throughout the rack. Once it gets to a server level, we need a DC to DC to go down to 12. 12 is distributed across the motherboard and goes down to the subsequent voltages. In telecom centers, they already use 48 volt buses heavily, the standard there for many years. So the test setup, what I want to mention here, the input is 60 volts in series with a 10 ohm resistor. Okay. There are a couple implications of that. One is this input current ripple you can actually solve now. If I told you I was putting a DC voltage source in parallel with your input capacitor, it's impossible to solve how much current goes through the cap and how much goes through this DC voltage source without knowing the impedance of it. The other is that that means that the input voltage to your converter is going to change with power level. So as you go up in power, you're going to be drawing more current from the 60 volt supply. Your input voltage is going to drop. And for the specs, depending on efficiency, it drops from 60 down to 50, 48 range over the full 60 watt. What you need to build in here is power stage, your power passive, your gate drive, any passives for the gate drives. Everything relating to generating these modulation signals, which is going to be a varying number. You're free to choose whichever topology you want. This might be 8 different set gate drive signals. It might be 2. Might be 1. Use a buck with a diode. Okay. But those can all be external, just connected into your board. Okay. Before we get to the PCB stage, I'm going to try to get a reference design for you guys there that you can use. You're also welcome to do your own thing. But if you need, you know, some additional circuitry here, that doesn't need to go on your board. It doesn't count against your volume. Okay. You need isolated supplies, other things like that. They can all be external. Okay. So there are in the full specifications document, which is on the webpage, there are limits on your converter volume, which was at 6 cubic inches. You need to be less than that. And there's also limits on the size of a PCB that I'm going to let you order. And it can be larger than your converter itself. And I want to give you some extra area on your PCB to add connectors and add probe test points and connections from signals coming in. But I still need to limit the overall area of the PCB that you're ordering, so I can get all these orders in. So the competition volume is going to be the minimum 3D rectangle, which encloses all of your components. Okay? The components are your power stage and gate drive, all passive. Okay? And that's what needs to be less than 6 cubic inches. Your overall PCB, I think, was 10 square inches. Let's look back at what I said. Okay. Let's see, schedule. So any questions on it? it's is by performance in that, but everything is thresholded save for size. Okay. So if you are the smallest size, but your weighted efficiency is 89, you're out. Right. But if yours is 90 and it's 1 cubic inches and somebody else's is 98, but it's 4 cubic inches, you win. Okay. The one caveat to that is that, and I don't have it on this slide, but it's in the document, if there's a tie on size, the winner is the one with the highest efficiency at that size. Okay. So, secondary, but also probably pretty unlikely that two people have exact same volume.
So let's see, I guess, a report deliverable or a demonstration or...
So I'm trying to the extent I can to minimize the amount of report writing and functional things. There will be a final report due during finals week. But, well, let's get into schedule. Okay, so we're here. Can't draw because of my thing. October 3rd, we begin. Schedule is going to look like this. 2 weeks from today, what I want is a design comparison report. And that's not a write-up kind of a report. It's more like a homework. And what that's asking you and your group of two to do is to look at 4 different topologies, analyze losses and size of them. And there's some requirements on that. At least 2 have to be soft switching, and at least 1 has to be a topology that we have not gone over in class. So you'll work in groups of 2. I expect you'll probably discuss, pick your 4, and then split up and kind of coordinate on what you're going to consider, but examine these 4. Like I said, I don't want you to turn in some lengthy report, introduction, motivation, all this stuff. I want it to look like a homework, okay? Here's the topology, here's my calculations, here's what I think we can do with it. Doesn't need to be full optimization, but it needs to be what you think needs to be put in so that you can make a selection on what topology you're going to go with, okay? Following that, you're going to have a week to take your selected topology and actually design it, pick components for it, pick values, figure out how you're going to implement it. And then on November 2nd, we're going to have the PCB layout due. And I'll try to order those same day if everything works out. We'll get them back about a week later. And then on November 23rd, there's a testing report, which shows the performance of your converter. There's no writing necessary in this. It's the template up there. You plug in a couple screenshots of the O-scope, you plug in the numbers from your testing, turn it in. Okay. And then the one actual report at the end of the semester, just documenting, here's what we chose, here's our analysis of it. Even that, the grading expectations are going to be very low on how good of a write-up it is. I'm not really looking for a report so much as just documentation of what you built and how it corresponds, how it performed compared to what you predicted. Okay. So all throughout, the purpose of this is to give you some hands-on experience with building these things. We're not practicing report writing, paper writing. Those are all valuable things, but I got other valuable things I'm going to want you to do. Likely the midterm will get moved to the week we're waiting on PCBs so that there aren't 2 things to be stressing about during that week, just the one. Okay. So likely we'll be targeting a midterm this week. Other questions? Yeah. Yeah, we're going to continue having homeworks. We're going to continue having lectures on topics related to the course. What I'm going to do is try to lighten up on those some, give you time to work on this as well. But this is going to run kind of asynchronously to the course. There's a lot of other topics related to high-frequency power electronics that I want to cover. So I'm going to do my best to make the homework's less of a load to give you time to work on these things. My homework schedule after homework 7 is a bit off. What else? There's a lot of practical details that go into this that generally we don't cover in lectures covering the theory of power electronics. And so that's why I've shoehorned in this magnetics discussion that we were talking about last time, and we'll continue a little bit today. It's more of a practical thing. What I'll try to do with these lectures that I'm missing is see if I can record some supplemental lectures on practical things, PCB layout, thermal design, that aren't going to be necessarily part of the core content of the course, something that's tested or in the homeworks. So it might be useful if it's something you haven't seen before as you're going through and building these things. But I expect that as we go through this, there will be things necessary to come up with a solution for, which are not covered in the content of the lecture. Depending on the topologies you select, there are going to be some issues unique to your converter that aren't covered in this class. And I think there's value to that. But those are things that you can always come talk to me about in office hours or outside office hours. And I will try to make additional resources available. Still figuring that out at the moment. Okay. So make sure today you figure out your group. Because I want everybody working in groups of 2. Come talk to me if you don't have a group. And maybe 1 group of 3, I've somewhat forgotten how many of you are not in the course. I have a couple auditors. So there may be 1 group of 3, but otherwise it'll be groups of 2. Make sure you figure that out ASAP so that you can begin working on this design comparison in your group. Okay. Questions, comments, negative feedback? Helps to stabilize the system. People excited about this? Does it sound awful? Both? Yeah. Okay. I hope that it'll be a good experience. First time we're trying this out. I think it's very valuable to you guys. All of you are here doing research in power electronics to get some experience with a different application from what you're working on. Okay. Like I said, there's a new page up on the webpage that has a full document of the competition specifications. The deliverables are listed on the course schedule as well as on that page. I talked about this. You do not at any point in this competition have to demonstrate any kind of closed loop control or regulation or really tune anything to be at a perfect operating point. I want you to generally get in the range of the output voltage. Similar thing here. I guess I should probably put a fixed number on it, but when I say 45 watts, if you're measuring and you're at 44.8, fine. Okay. It's not about getting exactly there. It's not getting near. I'll go back to the document and put in a percentage number on how close you need to be. All right. So like I mentioned, I do want to finish up on this magnetics losses. Like I said, this is more of a practical detail. I just want to get everybody on the same page so that as you go to design, now that you're being assessed on size and efficiency, that you can look at these magnetics and predict what it might be. So we talked about winding losses yesterday. Looked at AC effects on windings of magnetics, inductors, and transformers, including skin effect, proximity effect, fringing losses. Today we'll go over core losses. This is really an FYI slide. This is not going to be critical to your calculations, but I think it's good to know. So physically, where are these core losses coming from? And it takes somebody with a much better knowledge of physics than I have to explain this in detail. Essentially, inside a ferrite-type magnetic material, the magnetization of that material isn't uniform. Think about increasing the B field inside of it. It's not just that all the material goes up to that higher B field. What happens is inside the material, there are these localized domains where all of the material within this small segment at a microscopic level is completely saturated with the magnetic field in one direction. Some adjacent material is saturated with the magnetic field in another direction. If you look at the material as a whole, these magnetic fields sum up and cancel to give you your net magnetic field applied to it. If I have a coil and I put 1 amp, the field corresponding to that 1 amp is the sum of these little saturated segments. And this is a 20 micrometer resolution, or this distance is 20 micrometers, scanning electron microscope picture of a ferrite showing some of these domains. As you change the magnetization by changing the applied external field, the way that the material responds is these boundaries between the domains move, and they move in discrete steps. This is actually a quantization of the magnetization of the material, and that domain wall motion is a lossy process. Okay. It's interesting to know. It's not going to have a lot of impact on how we calculate things, but physically, there's really one loss mechanism for core loss. We talk about hysteresis and eddy currents and these different things. Really, it's all due to domain wall motion. So because of the complexity of this, let me go back for a second. This is really hard to model based on the physics because I need to know what this sort of geometry is for my material. And this is all at the micrometer scale. I don't know where my domains are, what those boundaries look like without doing a scanning electron microscope over my entire material every time I build an inductor. And it won't be consistent part to part even with the same material. So I don't have a lot of hope of physical models. And to date, physics-based models of inductor core loss have not yielded really useful results for the power electronics designer. So we have our empirical models. So the first and most famous is the Steinmetz equation. You've likely seen it's not in 481 in your previous power electronics course. This is entirely empirical. What I mean by that is Guy Steinmetz took a bunch of inductors, put sinusoidal voltages and currents through them and measured the loss. He said, hey, it kind of fits an equation that looks like this. Okay. The parameters of this, so FS is the frequency of the sinusoid going through it, delta B, the change in flux density, and then KFE alpha and beta are material characteristics of my core material. They can be obtained from manufacturer data. We'll look at that in the next slide. And this power loss is the volumetric power loss, the power loss per unit volume of the material. So the total loss is going to be that times the equivalent volume of the material given by equivalent area and magnetic path length, or magnetic equivalent area and magnetic path length. Problem with the Steinmetz equation is it's only true for sinusoidal waveforms. These parameters that you're using are obtained from measurements where they put in sinusoidal voltages and currents. So this really only accurately predicts losses for sinusoidal waveforms. Often applied for non-sinusoidal waveforms, but if you do so, you need to do so with the knowledge that this is not correct. There is no fundamental basis for why this should predict anything other than the waveforms it's measured for. So most core materials will have plots that look something like this on the left. I show this volumetric power loss versus delta V. Be careful whether this is amplitude or peak to peak. Different manufacturers may specify it differently. Make sure as you're looking through the data sheet, you read how they're defining this and adjust correspondingly. But now you guys are experts on digitizing plots. You can digitize this, curve-fit it with the KFE alpha and beta, and now you have your parameters. For most of them, if you look at the data sheet of a material, you'll get something like this. If you go to some app node on the manufacturer's website, you might get those KFE alpha and beta without having to do that digitization. Losses also vary with temperature. So for example, here, you see they're giving you the core losses at 100 degrees C because they're smallest at 100 degrees C for this ferrite material. Depending on the exact material, that minimum will shift, but for most ferrites, it's somewhere in the 70 to 120 degrees. Losses go down as you go up in temperature to a limited extent. So most often, you'll, if you're operating at 25, you'll find the ratio here and just multiply your results by that ratio. Say this is 1.5x larger, and for my operating point, I can calculate the losses multiplied by 1.5x if I think I'm at 25 degrees C. So for non-sinusoidal waveforms, there have been a number of attempts to come up with empirical methods for calculating the core loss. And the hope is that we can use Steinmetz equation parameters because, like it or not, this is the data that we're getting. This is all measured from sinusoidal waveforms. So this data is all going to be very well modeled by this type of relationship. The thing to note is that, just to make things even better, KFE, alpha, and beta vary with frequency. So your curve fit at 10 kilohertz is not going to be the same as your curve fit at 1 megahertz. Generally speaking, if I was using this material and I wanted to use it at 250, 300 kilohertz, and I can probably use my curve fit for the 200 kilohertz. And because this equation already has some frequency dependence, it should be pretty valid. I can increase my frequency and those parameters will still be valid. If I want to use it at 2 megahertz, I get nothing from this plot. This tells me nothing about the behavior there because the parameters are all going to be different. And if I use these parameters, even if I change that frequency to 2 megahertz, those are the wrong parameters. So this is not going to be a good material to use at that frequency. So the attempts to extend to non-sinusoidal waveforms have also all been empirical. Basically, the way they work is somebody says, let's try this equation. Let's see if that does a good job of modeling non-sinusoidal waveforms compared to experimental data. Hey, it does better. So the first one was this modified Steinmetz equation. It was back in the mid to late 90s. Basically, they made a guess that core losses should depend more on the rate of change of flux density than on the absolute value of the swing. That's based on thoughts from this domain wall motion that because it's the domain wall motion that matters. It's the speed with which those domain walls shift that really generates your losses. So what the modified Simons did was for your waveform calculate an average value of dB/dt of the rate of change of your flux density, and then find a sinusoid that has that same average value of rate of change, and then calculate using the Simons equation, but for this equivalent frequency rather than your actual switching frequency. So this is showing for a square wave of a certain duty cycle from 0.5 to 1 voltage applied to an inductor, what are the power losses? This is traditional Steinmetz. It doesn't care what duty cycle is, it just has the frequency in there. So those just stay constant all the way across. These two curves are measured in this modified Steinmetz equation, which shows the variation. Interesting thing is that here, for roughly 0.5 duty cycle, actual losses are lower than what the Steinmetz equation predicts. Right? And that's because if I look at, for a given delta B, a sinusoid will result in a sinusoidal delta B, a square wave will result in some triangular wave delta B. Triangular wave, for a given amplitude, has the minimum slope to achieve that amplitude at a frequency, right? Sinusoid, I got to go faster and then slower. This, I get the minimum slope to get between my plus and minus the same delta B. Make sense? Okay. So this modified Simons equation did a little bit better, but was problematic under some other test conditions. After that, there were really two methods derived independently around the same time. They're called the natural Simons equation and the improved generalized Simons equation. In between these, between modified and these, there was a generalized Simons equation, which was just mathematically wrong, so I'm not covering that. So the natural and improved generalized Simons equation, both two different groups came up with the exact same thing. Thought that they had both come up with something new, so they called it different things, but at a mathematical level, these are the exact same method. What it looks like is this here, with this Kn parameter calculated, it has some dependence on alpha. It's a modification. This K would be our old KFE. Yeah. And then based on alpha, you calculate some new K. This is the equation you get out of it. A simplified expression for square wave voltages with a given duty cycle. This one down here, it's the exact same equation, just pre-solved for square waves. Okay. This one does, you can see similar results here to the modified Simons equation that we looked at before. One of the things going on for a square wave voltage applied, lower losses than the Simons predicts at 50% duty cycle, much higher out here at close to a duty cycle of one. But there are, we just showed this result because it looks similar to what we were looking at on the last slide. There are other test cases where we, instead of doing a square wave voltage, we look at a sinusoid with the third and seventh harmonic, where this method does a lot better than the modified Simons equation. And it's pretty simple to calculate. Okay? Once you have these parameters, it's a different equation now, but if you're plugging into MATLAB, no more difficult. Okay? So I would recommend, in cases where your core loss is significant, to use this for your core loss prediction. Okay? One way you could approach it is to just use the Steinmetz equation if you find that easier, figure out if it's a significant component of your total losses. If it is, go to something more accurate. If it's not, okay, who cares? Don't worry about it. But if you're really pushing for high power density, small volume, your magnetics are going to be something you're really trying to make as small as you can. Right? And under that, you're going to go up in frequency, you're going to go down in magnetic size. Core loss is probably going to be a significant factor in determining your design. There are more complicated approaches. I'll give a couple references here. After the IGSE, there was the I squared GSE, and then the I squared GSE plus splitting, plus residual losses. There are some other something SEs that are more useful for specific kind of niche applications. A lot of that is covered in a seminar here by Professor Charles Sullivan out of Dartmouth, who did a lot of the work on core loss techniques. And then this is a seminar given at a conference in 2012, covering generally magnetic loss modeling, maybe a useful resource. But I'm not going to talk about any of these more complicated techniques. They are more accurate, but I think for most applications, this is about where the breakpoint is in terms of accuracy versus complexity, how much effort you have to put in to calculate. Yeah.
Are there any similar requirements?
They're not. Needs to work, needs to not overheat and blow up. That's your requirement. It's a lot of the reason why it's 60 watts instead of 300 or more is because I want it to be something where if you meet the TPE efficiency, you're likely going to have less than 2-3 watts of loss in the whole thing. And that's about the point where you just let it ambiently cool. If you have a design that needed a heat sink, that counts against your volume. If you need it, use it. I don't want things blowing up. Okay. A couple things here. So when you're looking at magnetics design for a given application, your goal is to minimize the total loss. Here, I'm just looking at a general curve in terms of, for example, number of turns. And I could use really any characteristic in my design here. I could plot versus peak flux density or an inductor, I could say versus air gap length. But for a given core geometry and material, there will be some curve that looks like this. If I go to higher number of turns, my copper loss is going to go up. For a window area, I'm going to have to use thinner wires to get more turns in. So it's going to be smaller area, longer length. And I'm going to have high copper losses, but my peak flux density goes down, I get better core losses. The opposite is I go down in number of turns. So for a given material and geometry, I can find, okay, if I look at my core loss, I look at my copper loss, I should be able to find what's the smallest amount of loss I can get out of this thing. Problem is I then likely want to iterate over different geometries, different materials. So a couple ways I recommend doing this. One, it's been real common in the past, I think it may be a bit antiquated, a spreadsheet-based design. So you can plug in, you know, all of your design through your magnetics into a spreadsheet, put in all these formulas for calculating core loss and calculating copper loss into that spreadsheet, and that'll allow you to go in and alter geometrical parameters and core loss parameters and have it automatically recalculate power losses and size. Then you can sweep over some different designs and figure out which one you like best. You guys living in the 21st century are privy to some better tools. I think MATLAB is generally a better way to do this. You write yourself a function, which is going to calculate losses in your overall converter or just in your magnetics, and then allow yourself to look over some different cores and different materials and quickly blast out, tell it to go brute force if necessary, just calculate all of them and then pick the design you like. I kind of recommend going this way. The last thing I want to talk about are planar inductors. The idea with the planar inductor is I can integrate windings into my PCB and then clamp a core around that PCB. This is a common technique when worried about power density and more specifically form factor. There's a couple good things, a couple bad things about planar magnetics. Okay? So nice things about it is you don't have to wind an inductor. For you guys, that's just an annoyance. When you go out into industry, that can be a significant component of the cost of your system because that's manual labor. There's no great machine that winds inductors. That's somebody winding it up. So there's good lower cost manufacturing, also better repeatability, because every one of these is going to be pretty darn similar compared to hand wound magnetics. A good thing is you can have these rectangular conductors, which if used correctly can be helpful in terms of skin effect, because rather than having a circular conductor where you have skin effect all around, this rectangular inductor, depending on the direction you put it, you can get a larger area while still keeping distances below the skin depth. Okay. You also have really good control over where the windings are in the window. So for things like fringing effects, I can quite easily say, you know, cut this conductor off here and get rid of these. And now I have all of my windings away from this fringing field if my core kind of sits, you know, here with an air gap around this thing. So it gives you really good control within the window on where you put these conductors. Problems with it, get rid of my scribbles. Looking at this, this is a cross section of the PCB. If I cut it here and looked at the side of that, first thing you notice, the fill factor on this is horrible, right? If I took this same window area and used round conductors, I could pack them in. And if I'm really good, I could get a fill factor roughly 4R squared over pi R squared, so kind of 4 over pi of this, because if there's circular conductors and it's a square window, so I'm going to lose some and get up in the 0.5, 0.6, 0.7 kind of fill factor, how much copper is in there. Here, I'm looking at 0.05. Okay. I'm going to have a very limited amount of copper that I can get in that same window because I have just this big chunk of prepeg of PCB material where I can't put any windings. Okay. For the competition, I am planning to order 6-layer PCBs, which makes something like this an option. Okay. Considering the hit you take in fill factor, likely for the same design, this planar magnetic has to be bigger than a traditional in terms of its own volume. But in the end, it may result in a smaller design. If you look at my example here, these really tall inductors and all these surface mount components. So even though this inductor had whatever its volume is, pi r squared times the height, all of this space over here ends up getting wasted because I've got this really tall component and I don't have anything that I can put over next to it. So if I put a planar inductor here and it was, you know, bigger, but its height was very small, now my new rectangular enclosure has this really small height, I'm going to get down to a smaller volume. So by no means a requirement. Traditional magnetics are fine to work with. There is, it's open in terms of how you choose to implement your magnetics. You can wind your own normal wire wound. You can, I don't really have anything to show anyway. There's nothing important on the slide right now. You can wind your own traditional. You can use a planar design. You can buy a wound inductor or transformer if you can find one on DigiKey or Mouser that you like. But I just wanted to make note, it is a six-player PCB. Otherwise, the traditional options are detailed in the design document. So if you want to go this direction, that's an option. The important thing throughout the competition is that when you're selecting components, you need to make sure it's something we can buy and get in time. So you could find the best Fed and the best conductor core out there, and if they've got an eight-week lead time, find something else. Okay. With this, right. So there's at least very little option. You can change ARIAP, but you can't change number of turns. You could add vias for separate taps and then short one out if you want to have some different options, but you need to be pretty confident in your design to go this direction.
How is that cross section? Are those views?
So
the top of that red box you drew, is that top
software? Right. So it would be this kind of flipped in that direction. So this would be my top copper. This is only a four-layer design. This is my bottom layer. There are no vias in this. This would be mid-layer one, this would be mid-layer two. And then this here is part of a circular hole that the middle of that core went through. And then the outer section of the core was here.
At the top of the red box, not the right, it's the top of the operator. Is there copper at the top of the red box?
Saying, is there copper here?
Yes.
No. That's just PCB.
Okay, so is this four different traces? Like four different windings, I guess?
I kind of drew it like this. Here's my PCB on the top. It was a high step down transformer that we cut open. On the top, there's some 10 turns. So it's a thin track that spirals around 10 times. Second layer, one big single turn. Third layer, back to the primary. The advantage of what? For this, it was a 12-to-1 transformer. So I have, I believe, my numbers might be a little bit off, 24 turns on the primary, 2 turns on the secondary. And given that, always in your design, you want the biggest conductor you can, there's always this trade-off when you design a transformer of how much area do you give to each. But for this, it was a 12-to-1 step down. This was actually that dual active bridge I showed earlier. So it was 150 volts to 12 volts. 12 volt winding conducts 10 amps. 150 volt winding conducts less than 1 amp. But I wanted to have much thicker windings on the high current side. The losses would be comparable. So that's all up to your design, right? I could have had any of these have any number of tracks and any number of turns.
It's just fascinating.
Absolutely. So there is, because I now have these parallel plates, some capacitance here. Depends on how that affects your converter operation. For some, this was a buck converter and this was my inductor. That trace-to-trace capacitance is just adding a little bit of extra switch node capacitance. If it's an isolation transformer, I now have capacitance across my isolation barrier. That can cause weird things. So it depends entirely on your application, but something to be considered. Any other questions? Okay. I will see everybody next week. Send me an email with your partner, your team for the design competition by Wednesday. And if you don't have that, come see me soon. Okay. But it's not as much as